Yes, it was, actually. But
you're just more outspoken than I am. That's what I meant. We're really excited. What we hope to do is to have a conversation. And so in order to be able to have a conversation, it's good to have a context of who we're talking to. So before we start, we just thought we'd go around, tell us who you are, and where you're from. I need to go recognize most of the faces, but maybe other people don't know everybody, so.
No, it's not.
Noah.
He's
in New York.
I am from here, but I now live the last 8 months in St. Louis, Missouri. I'm the Rabbi of Florina.
What's your name?
Noah Arno.
My
approach.
Originally from Argentina, Rabbi in Atlanta for 15 years, Congregational Kaddish.
I'm Francine Raskin. I live in Montana. I was full-time pulpit rabbi in New Jersey for 16 years, and then I am on a self-made sabbatical. And I, do Jewish stuff.
So Francie, tell them where in Montana.
Northwest Montana, Whitefish, and half hour of Glacier Park. So if you ever go to Glacier, which you should because they're melting, kosher meal at my home.
Because there's no kosher food anywhere else.
What's the nearest airport?
In Canada,
Glacier. I'm in Cosper. I run the Center for Cosper Education here at UTS.
Randy Mark, originally from Minnesota. I was longer in New Jersey though than I have in the Midwest. In my current pulpit for 20 years.
Barbara Spier, Bostonian, and transferred to Austin, Texas, and then to Los Angeles in the single school first class ordaining rabbis. And I've had the same job at the VA hospital in West LA. I'm the only full-time female Jewish chaplain in the VA system.
Sarah Zachariah recently returned to Brooklyn, New York, where I've lived. Had a 30-year spiritual journey throughout the country. I am now refashioning myself as an independent rabbi for hire. So I'm doing a lot of teaching and all sorts of things, hiring myself out. Since my story is of a Haredi girl in Brooklyn becoming a conservative rabbi, I'm in the middle of spending some time writing my memoir and asking to be invited out to communities to talk about it.
I'm Susan Grossman. I've been in my pulpit for 18 years in Columbia, Maryland, 20 minutes south of the riots, and Baltimore, and concerned about that. And we are, and that's my second pulpit. I was in another pulpit for 8 years in New York and Westchester. I'm a New Yorker that has finally accommodated myself to the community of Maryland. So I'm happy to be back in New York.
Gary Creditor, Richmond, Virginia. Hired from the pulpit, working as a hospice chaplain.
Jared Douglas, Staten Island, New York, Rabbi Narmore.
Always. Never lose your title.
Dan Salzberg, I have been in Hamilton, Ontario for the last 9 years, and I'm currently moving to New Jersey.
Where?
Bridgewater.
David Ellibert, originally from Montreal, and been serving for the last 4 years in Colton and Albany.
Art Vernon, I'm 11 years in West Hempstead. This is my first full-time congregational job. I was in Jewish education for 27 years. Greetings from Paul and Barbara.
David Lerner, grew up in New York, 2 years in West Hempstead, and spent 5 years as a rabbi in Chicago and 11 years outside of Boston in Lexington.
Name and where we are?
Yes.
Okay. I learned fast.
Carolyn Braun, I was in the first class and graduated in 88. I went to Mount Holyoke College as a chaplain for, Jewish chaplain for 6 years, and I've been in Portland, Maine for 20 years.
Hi, David Levy, living here in New York, finishing my third year as a director of USMAR.
And actually, my name is Menachem. I'm in Berkeley, California for the last 8 years, and before that in Sharon, Massachusetts for five. I hope so. So we are, the title of our talk, of our conversation actually, is ambiguous enough to be almost anything. I brought something to hand out that has nothing to do with what we're going to be discussing, but because I don't like wasting trees, I'll give this to you when we're done. But the conversations that we've been having as a community are very, very not as nervy as I think they need to be. As a rabbinic community, there are things that some of us have hinted at in the questions that we've asked. The panels have been alternating between engaging and oblique, and the absence of women rabbis on the panel talking about women rabbis was weird, to say something gentle. But what I want us to be able to do, what we'd like to do is engage in a conversation to hear where we are on these questions, and perhaps to frame it just a drop, and you don't have to look, but I put the text I'm about to teach on Twitter and on Facebook on my most recent post. You might be familiar with it. It's a Rashi from Parshat Mikates. It's my favorite Rashi. So the pasuk is, Vahi boker vatipaim rucho. This is about Paro. Paro's waking from these dreams. We hear about the dreams. And he wakes up, and the phrase is Vatipa Emrucho. We'll come back to that one in a moment. Vaishlach Vaikral Kol Khartume Mitraim Vel Kol Khachameh Vaisaper Parolahem Et Chalomo Vein Poterotam Nefaro. So this rough translation, it came to pass in the morning that Pharaoh's spirit was troubled, Vatipa Emrucho. So he sent and called all the magicians of Egypt and all of its sages, and Paro related to them his dream, but no one interpreted them for Paro. So Vatipa Emrucho etymologically might be connected Vatipa Emrucho. Patmon, his soul rang like a bell. There's something about it that's agitating. It vibrates. It's very intense. And Rashi is quoting Midrash Tanchuma, where there's a parallel verse in Daniel, where Nebuchadnezzar wakes up from a dream, but the phrase is Vatitpa Emrucho, as opposed to Vatipa Emrucho, so there's an extra tough. And they're trying to figure out, well, what would the difference be? So Rashi, you need to see the original text, but Rashi says it this way. And I'll just use the translation. This is, by the way, the greatest thing, unfortunately, Chabad.org has, you know, just the best website in town. And that's not unfortunate if you care about learning and you don't care about the brand. Unfortunately, we haven't decided it's important enough for us to generate ourselves.
Good use of feedback here.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So Vatipu Imrucho, his spirit was agitated, knocking in him like a bell, Kippa Amon. Like Nebuchadnezzar, however, we hear in Tanakh, Vatitpa Imrucho, so there are two reasons for this. One is forgetting the dream, and the other is in ignorance of its interpretation. So the big difference, according to the original text in Tanchuma, is that when Nebuchadnezzar wakes up from this agitating dream, he can't even remember what his dream was, and he doesn't know its interpretation. When Paro wakes up from his dream, he remembers his dream because he describes it. Vein poterota, but no one can understand it. So perhaps in this dream state, both of them, bless you, both of them were able to recall, right there, in the dream, what's this dream and what does it mean? Right, so you could take Freud, you could take anyone. There's something happening in them. It could be a channel of a message from God. And they know what it means. But then when they wake up, in that moment, it's this great moment in the movie Hook, that Tinkerbell says to Pan, in between asleep and awake, that's where you'll find me. Right? Where you sort of hold on to the magic. This is fading a little bit, but you know it's there. Paro remembers the details of the dream, but not what it means, not the implications. Nebuchadnezzar wakes up. All he knows is that he dreamt. I think, this is maybe a launching pad, when we speak about egalitarianism, or when we speak about the way egalitarianism triggers things within us, because it's not only about one halakhic question, this is about a worldview. This is about how we see God, how we experience each other in the world. I believe that for some of us, and I'm just speaking personally, it has a lot to do with dreams. But dreams in the deepest of senses, right? It could be the stirring of the divine within that perhaps I'm more in touch with when I'm not paying attention to the physical world around me, when I'm not looking over my shoulder, as Chancellor Eisen said yesterday, to see what someone else will think about a truth that I hold dear. It might be that those dreams are more accessible sometimes than they are other times. And I know that in the real world, not only of the rabbis, it is sometimes hard to feel dreams become manifest and to be part of being an agent in their becoming real. It's very dangerous, actually. I have a board. I'm not alone. So what is it to speak truth? I have a community. At times when I've tried to speak my dreams, I've done so indelicately. And that's been very difficult. Not only for me, obviously, for people who I care about. And so the challenge, I think, when we have these conversations is to be brave enough to speak our truths, to actually let our dreams out just a little bit, and perhaps to intentionally, for the second when we're letting out, forget about what they mean, so that we can actually hear each other's dreams very well, and then explore what they can mean in a collaborative sense, because it would be no fun, less God, it would be no fun to dream alone, and to know what it meant with certainty. I would much rather be in a room full of dreams, of dreamers, and figure out how to make it somehow mashmuti together. Between all of us, there could be meaning discovered. So just as a kavanah for now, that text has always moved me because, you know, and I imagine I'm not alone in the room, my spirit is always agitated. And I think that's a good thing, actually. It means that there are things in the world that have yet to be that we can be a part of.
So we wanted to do two things in this session. The first is to go back to that dream for just a little while and to think about what that dream really meant to us. And then to talk more practically about where we go with that dream and how to bring it manifest. So what I would like to do is just to open up a conversation for us to step back into that dream to say, what was the dream of egalitarianism? And I especially want us to think about this in a particular context. Right? I hear a lot in the worlds I travel in, people who say what keeps them in conservative Judaism is egalitarianism, and that's the defining point for them. And on the other hand, when you ask what that means Jewishly and or when we hear from the outside, right, to hear that, it almost comes out often like it's just some sort of social idea that was out there that we just brought in and decided we had to make it Jewish. And so what we want to go back to is, what was the Jewish dream of egalitarianism? How is it rooted in our Jewish values, Jewish ideas, even Jewish texts? And just as Menachem said, to be able to hear each other for a few minutes to recapture that dream. So anyway, Susan, were you going to say something?
I'm thrilled we're having this conversation. I didn't know that this was going to be the conversation. So I guess I have a comment and then a request that if we use the, and I've spent my whole life on egalitarianism, so it's not because I don't think it's important, but my request is that we see, whether or not we expected that this was the conversation about visioning, to look at this as an example of other kinds of visioning we can also do. So just sure. I want to help everyone sure. be on the same page.
Yes. And then and we are going to get to the practical vision of where we want to go.
That's yeah. conservative, you know, like yeah. soul and Torah yeah. and all that jazz. Yeah. That's what I thought we were going to talk about. But I want to share with you a quote from Senator Elijah Cummings, which I heard this morning on CNN. As everyone knows, there was riots 2 nights ago in Baltimore, and Very powerful interview. If you can get it on the internet, it's really great. And he said something so powerful that we, I think, can learn from, apropos the conversation right now. Because your comment just gave me the light bulb went off. So he said that if we can hear people's pain and basically help shape that and direct that, that's where their passion, that's going to drive their passion. And from that, it'll help them find their passion. And from that passion, it will give purpose. And so, having been the first generation of women in the rabbinical school and being part of the earlier feminist movement, my pain was lack of access, lack of egalitarianism. That's where my pain was. That became my passion, and that's where my passion was driven, and that was my purpose. And I'm as I look at my children in the congregation and their parents, who are a generation behind us, and we're trying to think about why is the third generation different than the first generation, my question is there no pain there? Is the pain so diminished because the opportunities are there that then the passion isn't there? Because that's not where the passion is. The passion is search for spirituality or whatever the passion is. And then, therefore, it's hard to stay focused on a purpose of integrating true egalitarianism, the implications of consistency, all those issues, because, you know, the pain and the passion is weakened because of how we've structured our amorphous policies. So, just something to think about. It's part of the dream that I don't have an interpretation of the world, but I'll throw it now.
Okay. And please, Stephanie.
So I'm trying to think back on how conservative we were in the first generation. So if I talk about, at least how conservative we thought we were. So if I talk about what the dream was for me, it was women wearing tefillin and men taking care of the babies and baking cotton, and that one could do whatever on that spectrum one wanted to do at the right time. And so it wasn't a vision of change, it was a vision of inclusiveness on both sides, that both of these were Jewish roles and that both of these were open to men and women.
Thank you.
So, and I'm reflecting on both your comments. I was thinking that while I was waiting for the doors to open since 1979, I didn't want it. For me, it was more about access. It wasn't about it. Obviously, it was about equality. I'm from Berkeley. So I'm from California, so you know, I grew up on. I tasted that all the time. But for me, it was more of the opportunity to learn and to teach something that I really loved. That's still my passion, and my problem is that's not the passion of the people I'm teaching. And that gets really blended in and mixed up into being a woman, being a short woman, being a young-looking short woman, and there's this difficulty that has stepped in. And when you said about men baking challah and women wearing tefillin. You know, wearing tefillin is such a cool thing for me. I'm the only person in the entire minyan, who wears tefillin. And actually what that is everybody thinks I'm weird. And so there's this, I hear this vision and I just find myself just so, anxious. I want that vision. But it's not the vision of the conservative people that are in my pulpit.
So it's interesting, just to add to that. So when I go around and I speak to women's groups, I actually have come to that vision in a sort of a backwards kind of way. I will often bring them a source sheet of many of the sources that Joel Roth used in his tshuva. And I call the session Jewish Women, Where Have We Been and Where Are We Going? Right, choices we make and so forth. And it's really fascinating because they're starting from a place of complete access and assuming that this is Jewish life. And all of a sudden when I talk about how we understand rights and responsibilities, right? It's a whole new conversation. And I'm not sure that any of them have gone out and started wearing tefillin yet, but even to open that conversation in a different kind of way that says, you know, this isn't just about what our rights are, but this is about, you know, a Jewish understanding of responsibilities. And just to be aware that this is how we got here. And what does that look like? And it's been fascinating, the conversation that it's engendered. I don't mean that as a pun. It's engendered in terms of really getting people to start stepping into that place of understanding that vision that was. Anyone else? Yeah.
So there was a moment in time when I had an image of a waking dream, as it were, that I would have already taken all of the courses required for the rabbinical school before the doors were, you know, before the doors were open. And I had an image of myself banging on the door. It was like a medieval door, you know, metal door of the translator's office with one hand, and the other hand holding my transcript. Transcript of a graduating rabbinical student and saying, what are you going to do about it?
That's Mark Luther and the 17th.
Exactly. I didn't know that. Only later. So it was for equal access. And equal, I mean, I was already wearing tefillin and so on. For me, that had come, you know, through a whole journey of equality of obligation and opportunity. But then it morphed. I mean, I guess as equality of access became a reality, more or less, then it became a dream of actualization. You know, someone here said to me, we let you in for the first year. We let you in. Now you want to be different too? You want to be who you are uniquely. You want to be, don't want to be a rabbi just like me. You want to be a rabbi. So it shifted into a yearning and a demand, both a yearning and a demand for the embrace, for the celebration of different kinds of rabbinic service based on gender and all kinds of other markers of identity and soul.
Thank you. David?
So, it's an interesting conference to come to it as a man. I certainly feel very connected to this whole movement and egalitarianism, growing up in it, and these fights and struggles. There's a famous family story in my family of my sister, 6 years younger, not going to school on October 24th, 1983, because she told my mother that today is an important day because it's a vote on whether or not women can be rabbis. And she was in first grade. And so she said, I don't have to go to school because it's like you have to. I don't want to be a rabbi. So I feel very, you know, connected to this whole movement. And she did not become a rabbi. I became.
It's because she didn't go to school that day.
They explained how to get in the JPL.
It's a big day. You know, just seeing that whole transmission. And the part that's really interesting for me is I have a daughter who's about to turn 14, is to see sort of this next generation think about that. What I'm most disappointed in is that it feels like we're in some of the same place we were 30 years ago. And that to me is very frustrating. I'm a person who likes to see the world moving like a helix, not like a circle, which is a big part of being a Jew. And I think the things that are the same are, you know, she goes to a USY event, sorry to bring that up, but she's very active, thank God. And, you know, there's no other girls who model this. There are boys. It's not just weird. It's a gendered thing. It happens at Camp Ramah in New England. It happens at Rusi events. And she's about to go to again, a pluralistic Jewish high school. And she's already told me. She's like, I don't want to dive in the conservative minion. No one is serious. Dive in there. I'm going to go to the Orthodox Union. And it was just like, and it's not just for her, for me, it's a dad and my daughter to pick out another kid, a girl who I've worked so hard with, you know, was so committed to all of this sense of egalitarianism and left that all behind. And I'm just wondering what it is that I'd like to think about differently, that we should think about differently. Like, how is it that, you know, some of the progress I feel is just slipped right away, and I'm stuck in some same conversations I had 30 years ago, and I'm like, what? This is ridiculous. This is the same conversation.
I grew up in the Reform Movement where, and I was ordained in the Reform Movement, where the issue of women was never an ideological issue. And what was astounding to me was that the Reform Movement ordained Sally Priestand in 1972. Why did it take so long? I mean, when it was okay for so many decades, I mean, historically, Lily Montagu served as a rabbi in England without being a rabbi. Why not? And so I realized that there are several things going on all at the same time. And one is, and somebody mentioned the word, you can change the law, you can grant rights. Changing culture is a much longer process. And so, I will tell you, as a child of the 60s, and being affected by the feminist movement and my wife and so on, it was always astounding to me, and has been astounding to me, at how little change has actually taken place in the way men and women do various things, which we thought was all going to change because of the women's movement in the 60s and 70s. So I think I kind of pulled back a little bit and said, you know what, I'm not going to worry about outcomes. I'm going to worry about options. The issue is that the options have to be out there, because I don't know why a particular individual from a particular background or circumstance is going to choose this path or that path. But I think for both men and women, we want to be able to choose whatever path we want in life without feeling that we are defined by our culture. There are circumstances that may define us. We have physical limitations, abilities, and so on, but that we're not defined by our culture. I would like to see more women wearing tefillin. I would like to see more women wearing chalazim. But that's not my choice. That's their choice. They have the option. So I don't know. So how do we get more people who have the option to exercise that option?
I'm not responding to them directly. I wanted to say this before, and I want to talk also about the options. When I got to USLI, I was shocked by the absence of in ritual garb, and said to the first group I ever had, was like 100 kids at a board weekend, and one young girl came down, a young woman came down with a talis. And I said, how many of you wore tally to your buttons? 25 hands go up. Where are they? Like, are they in the sleeve of your suitcase, and you came down and no one else had it, so you went and put it back? You know, what's going on? And I struggled with this. It's been a campaign since I got there. Thank God we're making progress. We're finalists for a major grant from Hadassah, you know, on this. We have girls now coming to conventions having bed bars stolen from their synagogue to wear them in pink t-shirts that say we put the gal in egalitarian, which isn't the first thing I would have chosen, but it's cute. But the struggle I have, to come back to what Art said about options, is that we thought we hit equality when we took something that was an obligation for men and made it an option for women. It couldn't be an option. It's not enough. And people say to me, they look at the USY International Convention and go, why are only 10 young women here wearing tefillin? And I said, where are their rabbis? Who told them they should wear tefillin? Who made it just as important to buy a pair of tefillin for a young woman as a young man?
It's not an option, actually. I think a lot of shuls is not an option.
Can I?
But I think that we're skirting a different problem, for most of the boys in our congregations, most of the men in our congregations, it's as not optional, as irrelevant as it is for the girls. And Carolyn, I think that you would still be the only person in your minyan in the morning wearing tefillin, regardless of gender. Because I struggle with it in my show, which is a traditional congregation. And
David,
yet, I'm sorry.
That's okay. I just want to kind of bring us back to the original question, yeah, because tefillin is only but one small part of that, and I know it was a big part of how we got to where we are, but it was a symbol. But really, like, what does it mean to have had this dream of equality? And really, I mean, and think beyond, if maybe if you were someone who that dream had content even back then for more than just women, that's okay to say now too. We're going to get to where do we go from here and what does that mean for our Jewish life? But what is and what was the dream of really saying, like, we have this community of people who would all be looked at equally? Judah, I know you've been waiting very patiently.
We created something in America, in a conservative movement, that nobody else in the history of Judaism ever created. You know, Orthodoxy, nothing. Orthodoxy will claim that nothing ever changed, and that everything that they found in the 17th or 18th century was as Moses brought it down from Sinai. And Reform stands for the principle that you recreate Judaism in whatever form you require in your era. We created something over which we lost control. Namely, we educated boys and girls the same. And at some point or another, we said to the girls, this is where you get off. I'm going back to when I was a kid. And the girls with whom I grew up weren't prepared to accept that, and neither were their mothers. Maybe their fathers were. First time I ever encountered this kind of issue about 45 years ago in Camp Ramah, when a Roshe Das said to me, we're going to present the option of girls putting on tefillin. And my gut reaction was, I'm not sure that I want to double the number of people who are going to honor an obligation in the breach. And our issue, tefillin is very important. Various ritual objects, very important symbol, because if it's treated as equally optional for men and women, then it's not a requirement for anybody. And what I don't want to minimize the challenges of egalitarianism. They haven't been met. In the sense that we envisioned, you know, when Letty Ivervin said last night that in 1976 I saw that I was sure that by 1979 we'd have the problem licked. I can tell you in the same era, when I was in rabbinical school and we had the president and the executive director of the Women's League come to speak to the senior, mostly seniors in their practical rabbinics class, I asked the question of, okay, if we're an egalitarian movement now, it's 1974, if we're an egalitarian movement now, why do we need sisterhoods? Right? I didn't understand, you know, that women need women. The same way that...
Today we're hearing people, that men need men.
Yeah.
Right.
But and I was told that, and I didn't get it, and I get it now.
Okay.
I've grown up.
Okay.
But the reality is that our movement has fallen short, not only for women, but for men too. Because we often, lots of places that are doing a great job of it, but we often fail to articulate what we stand for. And often where we do articulate what we stand for, you have a leader and no followers.
Okay. So I'm going to take a couple more comments and then we're going to move forward again, reminding people that what we really want to hear is what was that dream? Not what have we accomplished or what haven't we accomplished, but what was the dream? Let's go back to what we thought we were trying to do and what it meant to us spiritually, religiously, in the world, etc. So Ben and then Francine,
well,
and then we're going to...
First.
Francine first, and then Ben. I was trying to make sure we got a younger colleague speaking. Sorry.
That is
not. I think Stan is the newest. Stan or Noah might be the newest colleagues in the room. So see, that's what I meant. This is the danger of knowing who got ordained exactly when you calculate in the world.
He's just going to stop.
In the last session, we asked people to identify themselves by their generation, and I identify myself as a second generation. And especially after interviewing and speaking with the first generation of women, right, their challenge was really access. I think that mine was, I had, access in the field, but it was more, the dream of egalitarianism was the dream of equal values and a level playing field. And that has not come to be. And sometimes there are these little pockets where there are people who have the vision, the strength, the courage, the confidence to be able to create in their little kiva equal obligation, right? When we don't have equal obligation, we don't have equal value. And when we don't have equal value, the men, as well as the women, will devalue the means vote. Because if it's an option for them, then, well, of course. I mean, what bungalow with me, whether I'm here. So the chidush that I've heard here, I have never in these walls heard such a resounding acceptance of egalitarianism. I didn't hear the word pluralism yesterday. I mean, I kept waiting for it because it used to ring throughout the walls all the time to quiet the egalitarian discussion. So this open acceptance and celebration of egalitarian, it's like been blowing my mind and moving me to tears. Because my dream was not just that we were in, but that we were full and equal players. And the culture will not change until the culture bearers. My dream is that the culture bearers, the people in charge of USY, JTS, all the other bazillion movement organizations, that they are embracing and celebrating and promoting a vision of egalitarianism that's full and equal value. Not options, but it's really an option for men, blah, blah, blah. Full and equal. And my fear always is to hear, absolutely, in the pulpit, egalitarianism isn't our issue, right? The issue is just valuing the atut. But if we all of a sudden start moving to the next narrative, we have to promote mitzvah, we have to promote musar, we have to whatever we do. If we skip over egalitarianism, then we're just like dooming, I think, ourselves to being just like some other movements, right? And so, I mean, I hope that this is this watershed of embracing and really saying, finally, we are an egalitarian movement. I've never heard someone who is a culture bearer and in power and at the top of any one of these hierarchical chains say we are an egalitarian.
Our short stint at the United Synod Convention in 1989.
Okay. We're going to let Ben
live it.
Ben, it's been waiting.
He didn't live it. I had to fight him to have full, equal, egalitarian counting.
Ben.
So I may offer something which I know is shocking. And I realize I'm one of the newest ordained people.
Very young.
Very young.
No gray in your beard.
I think we're missing the boat.
He just got called old.
Because I think, from what I'm hearing, at least, and I'm not trying to, I don't think this is the entirety of the conversation, but the way, at least in this room, and the way I hear it, is we're defining egalitarianism as medieval adherence to halakha in a male way. And that's never been my vision of halakha, of egalitarianism. I didn't grow up in USY, I grew up in a different movement. And, tefillin or whatever, I think that if we're talking about egalitarianism, it never looked the way that I'm hearing. It never looked that we all look the same and wear tefillin. That's what we're getting to. It looked that, I mean, I can be egalitarian until I'm blue in the face, I'm never going to be able to dunk a basketball, right? I can, to me, egalitarianism is allowing people to become who they are and empower them to become who they are, which means that they're not all the same. It means that this person expresses their Judaism in one way, this person, right? It's one of the reasons for me that, and I'm about to open a big can of worms, that Birchat Kohanim never bothered me, right? If somebody feels close to God because they were given the name Kohen and they can bless a group of people, the Zionism, it's not my theology, it's not who I am, it doesn't mean all the same. It means that I'm allowing for the circumstances to happen that my sixth graders, my seventh graders, boys, girls, it doesn't matter to me, are able to be Jewishly who they are. And whether they put on tefillin or whether they don't, they're going to have that choice, because we're having a conversation about whether or not we're obligating everybody equally, when, at least from what I've seen from conservative Judaism, outside of certain pockets in our movement, no one's obligated to it. And everybody that adheres to any halakha or ritual does it voluntarily. So the idea of chiyuv and whether we're going to obligate girls as the way we obligate boys, all we're talking about is that four times a year at a USY campus we see them. The other 361 days a year when they're not wearing tefillin, boys and girls are not wearing them either. So to me, the egalitarianism, we have to rejigger the conversation as and remove it from the idea of halachic
egalitarianism. We clearly have more to say, and we will have the chance to say more of it, and hopefully this conversation sparks many, many more conversations. To share a vignette that, Francine, I think, humbly, I think sort of speaks to what you were saying, and to do so in front of my father, because it's one that I shared with him. So growing up in Metni USY, I remember going to my first Kinnis, the No Experience Necessary Kinnis, where actually that's where I met David 4 years later, we had davening options. And the davening options at that time, I don't know what they are now, were traditional or egalitarian. And I remember going to my dad and I said, Abba, what does this mean? And he said, well, traditional is where men lead, and egalitarianism is where women also lead. And I said, Ima puts on a talis, that's tradition. And he said, no, that's what we fought for. And the power of that vignette, at least in the way that I've continued to experience Judaism, is really, it's a really important fissure line. The reason why Gordon Tucker's tshuva on LGBT inclusion was deemed radical was because he made effort in there to speak about an underlying truth. Which he claims, and I happen to agree, though maybe there's disagreement around the table, is a dream that conservative Jews, when they speak as conservative Jews, especially as conservative rabbis, rarely point to, which is that we actually do believe that halacha not only can change, but sometimes must change, and the must change is very much driven by our moral sensibility. So the accusation against it is moral relativism. There are all sorts of arguments against it, and each case should be judged as its own case. That's why halakha is so majestic. The power, however, of this conversation and us framing it as a dream is because, in a certain sense, this conference, is an attempt, I feel, as someone who's inherited the tradition that is egalitarian, to rewrite the narrative of its birth. What is it to celebrate egalitarianism where, at rabbinical assembly conventions at the Concord and elsewhere, where I was in the arcade, actually not involved at all, people were almost in fisticuffs talking about whether or not there should be such a thing. And, you know, the wonderful collection of responses is only partially so wonderful if actually we think we're celebrating egalitarianism. In fact, I remember thinking that David Rosky's contribution, his two-page contribution in that book, was just amazing, except that he fetishized a woman wearing tefillin. And so there are all sorts of dreams that I think we are claiming we share, and perhaps now, thank God, we do, which are actually not the birth dream of this thing. And as Susan was saying before, it's not only about egalitarianism, but as Francine also said, we haven't achieved it when it comes to that very basic thing that we think we agree about. And so what I'd like us to do, and I don't want to direct us in our thinking, but in terms of the tenor of our conversation, we should accept, as Ben was also saying, my younger colleague, which is not true. I think you're actually older than me. is that we have serious challenges and opportunities in terms of what chiyuv means in the first place when it comes to anybody. David Wolpe said a while ago here, I think it was at a convention, that back in the day we were teaching Jews how to play baseball because they were immigrants to America. Now they're immigrants to Judaism. I think we have very basic questions, and that isn't the question of egalitarianism. Right, the question of why are we losing resonance in the American Jewish landscape, and what is the truth that might actually unleash our magnetism again, has to do with recovering what we mean by the very word dream. Right? And so if we speak in dream-worthy terms, I think we stand a chance at having a real conversation and doing some real good. So I'm hoping that that's where we continue for the time that we have here and well beyond.
So I'll just add a couple of notes to that. So I have to admit that in the last 2.5 years, I've had more thinking and experience with dreams than ever before in my life. And that's been a wonderful thing, although I have to credit or blame, I'm not sure which it is, my mother's death for that. And that's in many ways how we work out the past and how we look at what we were hoping for. But I also think that there's the dreams that we live with that we want to make a reality that are a part of what we can all do in very practical ways. And that's really where we want to move this conversation now. And so I want to start also with a vignette and then open it up to coming back to a couple things I heard people talking about. I think it was Art who used the word cultural change. And we've heard it a couple of times. And I think, in my mind, that's one of the hardest pieces for us as rabbis to create our own cultural change amongst ourselves and even amongst how we think traditionally of halakha, or we think traditionally of women's roles and men's roles, given the text that we spend our lives devoted to. And at the same time, even more so when we try to expand that into the larger world. And having come from a business background, I spent a lot of time thinking about how is this really about change management, right? And what are we really trying to change, and how do we go about that bringing everybody along? And so it's led me to developing a little exercise that I do. Actually, you know what? I want to actually try to just... we won't be able to do it with everyone here, but I'm going to spend three or four minutes on this little exercise instead of telling you the vignette. So I want us to just think about, for just a few short minutes, what are the associations we ourselves have with a particular rabbi? Who's my rabbi? Who was my rabbi growing up? What did he look like? What did she look like? What did good, bad, otherwise? Like, what are the associations we bring to the table about? And you know, I'm not asking you to name any names at all. I don't want to hear the names. I want to know, and we're only going to ask about 5 or 6 people to share, and then I'll tell you why I did this. What are the associations you have with rabbis? What comes to mind?
The first rabbi that inspired me, he was always smiling. He knew my name when I was 4 feet tall. You know, mm-hmm. he cared about the kids. And he always made us laugh. And we knew he loved us.
Jewish texts were Jewish stories, because we didn't actually use text, but yeah. Sermonized. They were beautiful and they were interesting and they challenged us.
Okay.
But we never saw them.
I heard someone say old man.
If you recall Lenny Parker's description of Gershon Levy yesterday,
yeah. Okay.
You know, a lot of people shared that.
Other associations? Yeah.
Warmth.
Okay.
Caring about the person.
An idiot.
Music.
An idiot.
open.
That's as honest as it can.
Partly so you might be able to.
Rabbi, we're not going to make that.
Okay. That's why I'm a rabbi.
So here's the remarkable thing now. I can tell you why we did this, right? Imagine we were sitting around a room and you were all the search committee members trying to decide on who to hire as the next rabbi, right? And this were the first meeting. And you were not only getting to know your task and the sacred place that you'd been put, but also learning the process and getting to know each other a little bit. And what we all just named was our unintended biases about rabbis. And the unintended bias that could drive why we would choose a particular candidate versus another.
And it may be so totally misdirected that it's not
that's the whole point.
First question that's I was asked in one interview once was...
Judah, if I could, I'm sorry. I know that we all have personal stories and I don't want to turn it into a war story, but the reason that I share this is it's sort of my vignette in live action, right? Because when I go out and I talk to search committees, often in their very first meeting, I have them do this exercise, and I say to them, ladies and gentlemen, you have just named your unintended biases, whether positive or negative, and it's now your job to hold each other accountable, not to make the decision around any one person's bias.
Let's go.
Right? And that's part of the cultural shift that I think we're trying to talk about. Right? So how do we help uncover opportunities, challenges, biases, excitement, passion? What does it really mean to move into the future in take the next steps in creating the world?
I don't understand what you mean by unintended biases and why that's a problem.
Because... I like a rabbi who hugs me, or I like, or I picture a rabbi as the old man with the beard, and I don't like that, or I do like that. And all of a sudden, every candidate I'm going to see, I'm going to be measuring against that image that first came to my mind.
So limiting our
eye. And so, I'm sorry.
That you're having us move that to the.
No, so what I'm saying is, sorry, to first answer your question, is what I'm saying is that that's an opportunity to help people say, okay, in this moment, what are my unintended biases? And by the way, gender always comes up, right? Now, I'm able to, you know, really hit the point even further when I tell them, I'm sure you meant that in a gender-neutral way, because he in Hebrew means she, and I'm going to hear that in a gender-neutral way. Everybody gets the point when it's about gender. But it could be about sexuality, and it could be about other things, and it could be about the music. If I want a musical rabbi, everybody thinks that's the magical solution to what we need in rabbis, right? So for me, part of this is about how are we creating cultural change? How do we have conversations in our communities, not just when people are looking for rabbis, but in other instances that ask people in a safe and non-confrontational kind of way to encounter their own challenges in seeing the world in the way that they might actually say they dream it to be, but they don't live it according to that dream. Right? By definition, right, our community members have said they want to be part of a egalitarian community. Right? If your community is egalitarian, I'm assuming that we're all, maybe not everybody's is. But let's take a synagogue where they are, right? They've said that's a value and that's important to them. And so when we're not living up to that dream, right, one way is to combatively bring that to people's attention. My experience, that's not going to create healthy change, right? And so we have to manage the change in a different kind of way to bring people along and to open the conversation. And so when I start to think about, okay, where do we go from here, right? I really think about those deeply entrenched kind of conversations that we can open up in our communities in whatever way we're able to really ask people to step into the dream and to be willing to look reflectively at their own practices to see if it matches up to what they aspire to be. So I share that with you, but you certainly can use it as an exercise. It doesn't have to be just when you're searching for a rabbi. I think you could do it in a lot of different areas, and I'm happy to talk about how to adapt that. But really, that's not why I shared it here. Why I share it here is as an opener to say, like, what's the next part of the dream, and where do we go from here, and what would we want to see, and what does it mean to say we're celebrating 30 years and where we've gotten to, and there's still a long path. And I want to here say that, again, that I don't necessarily think that the conversation we have has to be exclusively about women, but because for some of us that might mean something, even egalitarianism might mean something way beyond just gender or sex, sexuality. But I just heard recently a rabbinical student who said to me that I don't have a gender, my sexuality is male. Right? And I think that's what they were saying, right? Like that I don't think in terms of gender roles, but if you're asking me, was I born as a man? Yes, I was born as a man, right? Which is a different conversation. But anyway, so I'm going to open it up, Ben.
So something you said, I don't know exactly what it was. I remember.
It's our long history. He never knows what I say.
When I worked in USY, in Far West USY, there was a document we used once, and it was written, it's obviously many, many years ago, called The Ideal Conservative Jew, or The Ideal Jew, and I'm sure some people around the table remember it. Okay. And it was if you read it now, I wonder how the vision we're talking about and the dreams we're having, how we would, you know, I know what it was. It was talking about the ideal rabbi, right? What are our biases for an ideal rabbi? So what are our biases for what the congregant we'd love to have looks like, or the student we'd love to have looks like? And, you know, how does that fit in with the fact that the very definition of regular attendance at services across religions at this point has gone from every week to twice a month, right? So how does our vision as rabbis of what an ideal conservative Jew, and the fact that at best we're talking 50% Shabbat morning attendance, do we have to reconfigure our notions of what it might be to have this movement flourish?
As we're jumping around, I just wanted to bring into the room, Arnie was teaching at RTI a bunch of years ago, and he was presenting a framework to see Weber and Durkheim as parallel to Kaplan and Heschel, other way around, that Weber was lined up with Heschel in terms of personal meaning, and that Durkheim was lined up with Kaplan in terms of communal program. And one of the exercises that we did as a group involved the changes that we would make individually as rabbis in our communities if we had carte blanche. Like, what are the three things you would change? And then the question was, are you doing that for you? Are you doing that for them? And so I just wanted to introduce into our conversation something that I think leads us in an unproductive, in the end, direction sometimes, in my experience all the time, which is to say, we have to shift our expectations of them. When I use the word dream, I actually am trying to figure out what I mean. And what I'd like us to continue to do as we're speaking, it's not just a social work theory of I language, is what do you care about a lot? Right? In this room, I am just very humbled to be in the presence of people who were part of the fight, who are themselves our, you know, chalutzot. This is a dream that I cherish, that I have dedicated my life to furthering, which is nobility of a Jewish life. I can't measure other people's attendance, and even if I could, I don't think that's what's going to motivate me, and if it doesn't motivate me, it's probably not going to work for them. So,
right. So, but what I do hear in what Ben said that is part of this conversation is there any way in which expanding our notion of Jewish meaning, or I would say recapturing our understanding of the different ways worship can happen beyond just prayer, any part of the understanding of egalitarianism? So I'm just posing that as a question, but I don't know if you meant that, but that's what I heard. Jacob, you haven't spoken yet.
Those are interesting you said that. First of all, I have found it to be incredibly valuable since I was barely old enough to be really aware of what was going on in the 1970s and early 80s, to be able to revisit that and to see it through the eyes of colleagues here who really were a part of that. It's been an incredible gift, because there is much that I take for granted that I forget really is just in a different space. And so echoing what Malcolm said, I think it's great that we created this opportunity and also to look at it through a different lens, one of celebration rather than anxiety, that we finally moved to the space of celebration instead of anxiety. I personally found that to be probably among the most meaningful places. And Cheryl, picking up on your point, I think one of the crises, and it's a good crisis to have, is a question of authenticity. Because I think that's a big piece of what motivates me. You know, I want to feel like I'm somehow connected to my tradition. But egalitarianism, especially when it comes to gender and sexuality, is such a means elevating things like vota briot to a central place in our value structure that it may or may not have had, at least in a more universal sense, in our tradition. That's been a radical shift. And helping my community and helping myself adjust, it took me a long time to feel truly authentic as a conservative Jew. Not looking over my shoulder at Chabad or at Orthodoxy, and not being able to make a complete break as I might have if I labeled myself Reform. And I think that's a space that I'm really trying to hold my community into and hold myself and my community accountable to, is to use a language of authenticity to say this is truly a matter of, this is an authentic space of evolution of our tradition.
So you might just find it interesting to know that last week I was teaching a session of a Hilchot Tefillah class to our first year rabbinical students, and the session was on gender and mitzvot, and I assigned them Joel Ross Tshuva, Judith Hauptman's article, David Fine's Tshuva, and Pamela's Bar Mash's new Tshuva, and their question was, why are we reading Joel Ross Tshuva? They really didn't understand, and even Judith Hauptman's article, they really felt like you know, really, they're like the only two really were, you know, David Fine and
it
was fascinating.
It doesn't feel authentic, and that's why I turn as I'm walking with the Torah, I'm like. Where's your talents? You know, like, you know, and because, and I think it's that because their parent, their mother does not wear a talit,
right,
and they're wondering, how does that feel authentic to me? How does that feel not just obligated but authentic to me?
Yeah, no. Esther, then Noah. Sorry.
I don't know everyone in the room, and I wasn't there yesterday, so I'm going to introduce myself.
Please,
Esther B. Yeah. I was ordained in 2001 here, and I've been working at Rutgers well ever since. And if you don't know me, if you could introduce yourself at some point, I'd appreciate it, because I'd like to know all my colleagues.
Yeah, we did do that at the beginning of the session.
I was late, so that's my fault.
Yeah, that's
so
okay.
I'll love to meet the individuals there. So I have so many reactions, I want to keep this really brief. But, you know, I work with college students, which might be a different population from some of my colleagues. And I think this thing Jake was talking about of authenticity is so real. College students are really looking for, you know, what is real Judaism. Some of them think that Chabad is it. Mm-hmm. On my campus, I happen to be on campus with a bunch of Chabad. But there are others who are really searching for something more than just shots on Friday night. And so they're looking for something deeper and opportunities to learn and daven and grow. What'd you say?
Shots on Saturday morning.
Shots on Saturday morning. But when I say to my students that I believe conservative Judaism is the authentic inheritor of tradition going back to Sinai, and that we are right and the others are wrong, they want to hear me say more. Like, they want to know. When I was first ordained, I think the first, like, couple months, I was like, did that really happen? Am I actually a rabbi? How am I going to do this? Did they make a mistake? You know, all those kinds of things that self-doubt. But, you know, over the years, I've gained confidence in the work that I do, and I think that I'm talking about young people, but I think Jews in general are looking for an authentic rabbi to be able to transmit, this is our tradition, this is what we believe in, this is why it should be meaningful in your life, and it's incumbent upon you to
learn about it and take it on and be part of it. And I am concerned about my good friend here said some things that I actually disagree with. That, you know,
you wouldn't be the first.
Right. That my students can't have a minion every Saturday morning this year. They, like, tried it. It wasn't working. So 1 week they have Saturday morning, and 1 week they'll do a Sudash Shishi. Whether they do Mincha or not, they do something on a Saturday for Shabbat. And I think that that's more important than if I were to say, well, we'll have services every other Saturday because people have 50% of the time or whatever it might be. I think that maintaining, for me, the commitment to halakha and authenticity of our tradition is what's going to make the conservative movement stronger. And the last thing I want to say is that I went to a conference this year, the Masorti on Top of Shabbaton, which was college students in the conservative movement, although they called themselves Masorti, having a Shabbaton. I was very impressed. I was really blown away. And it might be smaller in numbers than it had been. I don't know. I haven't kept track of the numbers. But there's a very, very strong committed core. And I'm much more interested in maintaining who we are and getting smaller than saying, well, we're going to start doing X, Y, Z that Amcha wants, but not no longer being true to ourselves.
Thank you.
Hearing from older colleagues, especially women in the first generation who have had to really fight to get in the door, is inspiring to me. And I feel pathetic in a certain way because they're not. I feel pathetic, not apathetic. I care. But because there have not been things that I have felt like have personally affected me that I have really needed to fight for. And maybe that's my own apathy speaking. But in the conservative movement at this point, there are not so many things that are left to really fight about. And that leads to a certain, perhaps, decline in energy that, you know, Menachem was trying to re-energize us to dream about a little bit. Being in St. Louis, and for those of you who are, you know, in Baltimore now, one thing that, you know, there are certain things that you are totally part of it okay to talk about in shul. Gender is actually okay. You know, folks with disabilities, that's okay. We can talk about pluralism. We can even maybe talk about Israel. Maybe it's complicated. Race is really hard to talk about. And if we're looking for ways to kind of re-energize and really challenge people, push their buttons in really uncomfortable ways, which, by the way, is what the whole egalitarian controversy, if you want to call it that, did in the 70s and early 80s, probably the 60s too. That's one place. I don't know how to do it. I'm trying to figure that out. I need all the help I can get. But there's energy when there's controversy and discomfort.
I have two daughters who grew up in a house not with one rabbi, but with two rabbis. They said last year in an event in the congregation that even in the club of children and rabbis, they have platinum status. So egalitarianism being egalitarianism was never an issue. They have not only two parents who are rabbis, but who share puppets. So who create together a congregation. So, and now they're out of the house, and I see them going to Orthodox services and I'm like, what's going on here? And once and again, what I hear is that they're more interested in finding the right community, the right spirituality, the right experience, and if they have to pay the price of sitting on the other side of the mechitza for the service, they don't care. So what I'm like, we got it. For them, it's natural, right? And they never fought for it. And if they have to pay for that, they are more interested in the other part. And I think that, okay, we got there. We now, they have full access. What do we do once they have full access and they come in? And that's what the dreams that we need to be with.
Yeah.
That the language of authenticity resonates a lot when I use that language with not with college students but with older folks. They love it, and it also allows you to use more inspiring types of language. I sometimes think this week, especially, I've been thinking about egalitarianism in terms of how it can conflict with other values that we purport to hold. I feel like get on Sunday. And give that get. Especially, I'm outside of Toronto. These people are getting married. They're ballpark my age. They're going to marry somebody from the Toronto Jewish community who odds are is going to be in a synagogue that's only going to accept male people, right? So it doesn't do. I'm not doing them any favors if I use women.
But concerning who doesn't allow you to, by binding,
you can't.
So I used my personal situation. And it truly, it was the first outside of life and death thing that are hard to get through. Ritually, it was probably the worst moment of my 9 years of being a rabbi. I felt like the guy I never wanted to be. I was sitting there with the people I had assembled in a moment with three sort of, you know, schleppy males from the congregation who I could get together. And woman who I like, but I've never really been able to connect with her, and she spent the entire time with her face in her hands. And then stood up, took it, and just handed back to me and walked out. And it was searing, and I knew it was going to happen, and I was trying to get around it, and it was searingly painful. But here was a moment where I wanted to be the guy I wanted to be, but felt that he's unable to do it, and it all came crashing together, and we've got to fix that.
So when we were outside...
I begged.
When we were outside waiting for the session to start, Deborah Newman Caymans came up to us and she said, I can't be at your session, because I have to be at another one. But it's really important in talking about the future that we really think seriously about engaging in what does this mean for marriage and divorce, and you know, who's going to write the tshuva for that to
work on.
The get one? Oh, great. Okay. Excellent. Great. So that's one that resonates.
I was on Arnie's cabinet for 2 years, when he came on, and then as he started. And one of the things I really pressed him on, he didn't listen to me, but I really pushed him on using the word authentic ad nauseum. And I have a really hard time. I am so impressed with you, sister, because I feel like, and maybe this is second generation versus third, but I just feel like a lot of my career has been trying to prove my authenticity. And we as a movement, because we never fully embraced egalitarianism, when we see authentic to our people, good, I'm glad it empowers you. But I looked and I'm like, yeah, because you have the nice black kippah and you're a guy. To say authentic, they're thinking, not me. Right? So, and how can I be fully authentic when I can't deliver the damn get? Right? How can I be fully authentic when I know I can deliver it, but I can't be one of the signer? But that was a new nice thing that they did for us. And with all kavod to all the work you've done, it's still we're not fully authentic. So to me, the authentic title, the fight for authenticity in the face of orthodox, it's really authentic. It's defining ourselves. We're authentic just like we're. And we're authentic in contrast to the other people. To me, I think we should have a healthier, better word. I don't know what it is. Depth is the word. Inspiring, invigorating, who knows?
I just want to point out, though, that I think what you're talking about in some ways is that same bias that coming from a different group in a different way than what I was talking about with the exercise that I do, right? And so engaging communities in what do we mean by authentic, and gently pointing out how that's right?
And my argument to Arnie was a fraught word.
It's a fraught. So if anybody decides to use that little experiment in your community, and maybe someone going into a new community, it's a great opportunity to talk about what does authentic mean to you, and where is it superficial and where is it real. I'd love to hear how that goes, so please remember that and follow up with me. Susan.
Not enough about yet, but I do want to talk about authenticity and consensus, and I think that the celebration, someone mentioned, the celebration element of this event, mm-hmm.
was a seismic shift because it reflected a certain degree of consensus, at least among the people who showed up and the people who organized the committee and had power in that, about egalitarian being okay. Where we still lack consensus, and that guy just talking about it,
Dan,
was that we don't have a consensus of what that means. And until we have consensus about what that means, there will be, which is the vision, which is the dream, there'll be very great difficulty about having the policies in place, the strategies in place, that and policies that will help sustain and promote it. And so when our United Synagogue, when our rabbinical schools, when our Ramah camps don't require the same things of girls that we require of boys, because we don't have consensus about not just women in Chiyuv, but Chiyuv in general, right? That means that we cannot have, that women will continue to be other. And that's, there's so many levels of the work we need to do on that, that, you know, that would maybe be the next workshop, is building that consensus about these areas. I'm going to come back to my dream, because that's where you wanted us to talk about. My dream included that women not just have equal access, and that we have equal rights, and that we have the doors open to us, but that we're also treated equally in terms of expectations as well as opportunities. And as part of that, it also included the values that the non-traditional places, kitchen wisdom, kitchen spirituality, was given value, but it didn't replace the value that we have historically, and that's expanded to allow men and women to make challah, but it didn't replace the value that we have historically, authentically placed upon traditional view. And if we, and it comes back again to you, we just passed Tshuva. It took 30 years more for the conservative movement to pass a tshuva that officially requires men and women to be treated equal in obligation. It took 30 years. And when it was passed, it was not celebrated. It was very quietly distributed. Everybody around the table who was a woman said, "Wow, we got to do something," and we just went on to the next piece of business. It was rather interesting. And when was that honoring the dream that so many people have had, but the lack of movement on that, and having a strategic discussion about that, that chiyuv, I think, is tied up in our question of egalitarianism, and that's also tied up in our effectiveness as propagators of being accepting, expecting, and motivating people to engage in the conservative movement. And it's a question that the Orthodox movement did years ago. When they shifted from being allowing to expecting, they experienced a bump and a clear vision. And so I would suggest that our next conversation about dreams maybe will shift beyond just the question of egalitarianism, because I think that really lies at the heart of our lack of success in this area.
Anyone else? Yeah, Amy. And then I'll say something that Menachem was going to say.
It's an incredibly wonderfully rich conversation, and this isn't usually my MO, but I feel moved to really offer some disagreement to expand the plurality of views at the table. The first thing is not controversial, I think. One is that I think we need to have an absolute clarity from the movement down that we oppose sexism, that we oppose discrimination, gender-based discrimination. I totally agree with you that that's not the way to bring hearts along. The way to bring hearts along is with exploration, but from the movement, we should have a clarion call that we reject, find immoral and counter to halakha, discrimination against women, and included in that is equal pay, equal access to jobs, equal value, equal respect, all of those things. An isur on gender-based discrimination. That, I think, on that, there should be unanimity. On everything else, I think that the quest for unanimity, and here I'm you know, respectfully disagree with some, you know, dear colleagues, is, I think,
unrealistic, unachievable, and actually un-Jewish. Literally every line of rabbinic texts. It's not an accident. Why are all those views there? Not just because they wanted a long document, not just because maybe one of those views would eventually be useful, but because it is as central to our spiritual practice every day, on every line, to keep shifting back and forth. Maybe this view is right. Maybe that view is right within a certain sexism, no, right? Within certain parameters. And to be constantly shifting back and forth, we're not Shulchan Aruch Jews. That was the aberration in Jewish life. Real Judaism, that's an outrageous thing to say, but our basic spiritual practice of rabbinic Judaism is to be constantly living in plurality and stretching our minds. And I think that's always been the case since the triumph of rabbinic Judaism. And I think it's especially true now. We are not going to turn back the clock. We are in postmodern days, and it's going to get more so. All of us who have, you know, children, some of the children are going back. Most of the children are going into a land of where everything is fluid. Gender is, but not just sex roles. Everything is fluid. And I think, to the extent that we keep chasing an ideal of unanimity in the movement, that confines us to boredom and angst and lack of spiritual authenticity. I don't mean, are you the real Judaism, but really what's going to set souls on fire is, can we go forward into the new world with what we understand, but with an openness, with a sense of creative possibility.
Right, and I think... funny for me to be the one saying this to you, but that's also about learning how to deal constructively with conflict, right? And what does that mean to actually live with side by side with people that we love, who we differ and disagree with, and communities that might have different opinions, and what that means? That frankly, our world could use a lot of new models in how to do that—not just our Jewish world, but our world at large. Just add one other thing. When I think about when I think about the future, and then I know I'm going to turn to Menachem to close, and that's that. You know, one of the ways that I have found it almost as a spiritual practice that I hope I can aspire to live up to, with regard to the opportunities that I've had as what I guess Francine has now said is a third generation rabbinic woman rabbi, because I graduated the same year as Esther did, and that it really has become for me the prophetic call to think about not just my own place in the world, but other people who are othered by our tradition and or by our world, and whether that's race or whether that's gays and lesbians, or whether that's how we deal with interfaith couples, or any other category we can think of. It's somehow, you know, for me, it's something that I carry with me every day. I think about how 100 years ago in this country, or a little more than 100 years ago, I wouldn't even be able to vote. And that privilege, I don't take for granted, even though I also accept it as a right. And that there's a way in which for others it's experienced as not just a lack of rights, but a lack of privilege. And to them, we look like the privileged few. And so that has become a driving force for me in really trying to keep myself as open to everyone, and to thinking about what that means. Sometimes I'm probably better at it than others, but it's really a discipline that I try to hold on to. And I just throw that out there as part of my dream for the future as well.
I have a lot to say, but I don't know. Chacham Adif Minavi, right? But it doesn't say Chacham Adif Minaviya. And so I'm sitting with Amy. And I had a lot to say before you spoke.
I thought you'd have a lot to say after I spoke.
I do, but it's different. And so we sang when we came in. Maybe we can sing for a minute on our way out. You want to do that one again?
Yeah.
That was great. You start.
La la la.